I'm Kate Archer Kent in for Larry Mueller on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. Trees could be considered the ultimate connectors, linking the deep past and the present, and standing at the nexus of soil, wildlife, people, and every breath we take. All of these relationships are unique for every tree, and they give each tree its own song. That's according to biologist David George Haskell, who is the author of The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In what sense do trees have songs?
They have songs at several different levels, and their song is something that is comprised, first of all, of the acoustic experience. And if you turn your ears to trees, you'll see they do, in fact, have sound coming from them. The sound of a maple tree in the early spring is very different from the same wind blowing through the tree in summer or the winter. So in the sounds of trees, we learn all sorts of stories about their physiology and the ways that they're connected to other creatures. And then, of course, a song is more than just the sound, the acoustic experience. It's also the stories behind those sounds. So in this book, I look at about a dozen trees around the world and first listen, open my senses to the tree to discern who it is and what the stories of its place are made of, and then discuss those stories by talking with people, reading the scientific literature, literally digging into the place to try and get under the skin of the landscape.
Your research took you everywhere from the Amazon to Jerusalem to Japan to the Rockies to Manhattan. What did you learn in all of these diverse places? What connections did you make?
So I chose trees, as you point out, in some rather different places that at least on the surface seem to be have very different natures. The middle of a big bustling city in New York, or the boreal forest of Ontario, or the tropical rainforest in Ecuador. These are all places that have very different human cultures, and the ecological context is, of course, very different. So there are all sorts of particular details that determine the lives of trees, but underlying that is this unifying theme that at each place the tree is interconnected with the life forms around it and gains its life only through those connections. And this is the revolution that's happening in modern biology now, that previously we thought of trees and human bodies as separate individuals. Well, in a way, we are separate individuals, but at a biological level, that individuality is in some ways an illusion. We have our lives only through relationship. And trees are great examples of this because they are nature's great connectors. They don't get to run around and escape. They have to live in the place where they find themselves germinating, and they do that through collaborative connections with creatures below ground, above ground. And sometimes those connections involve humans to a very large degree in cities or in the olive groves of the Middle East. So even though the locations were quite disparate, the story of interconnection and of humanity's role in that interconnection is a thread that runs through the whole book.
Let's listen to the song in the Western Amazon rainforest, the most biologically diverse place on the planet. Let's take a listen. Introduce us to this tree. Who is this tree?
So the recording was made from the very top of one of the tallest trees in the Amazon. This is a tree that the locals call a sabo. The scientific name is Ceiba pentandra, a tree that's found in tropical areas around the world. And tropical rainforest trees are quite tall, but this one towers above them. It's a big dome that rises above the canopy, so its branches reach out into the sky, 50, 60 meters above the ground. And so I made this recording standing in some of those branches, looking out across tens of thousands of square kilometers of rainforest in the western Amazon, a place that has very few roads. Most of the travel in this region is by river, at least most of the human travel in the region is by river. And what we're hearing is the sonic manifestation of this great biological diversity. At dawn, the monkeys start calling, the birds, the winds start stirring the leaves, insects revive in the daytime, insects revive in the strong rays of the sunshine. And so this diversity that we can visualize on a map, if you draw a map of the most diverse places on the world, biologically diverse, this part of the Amazon stands out as one of those. You can hear that. It's not just a visual phenomenon. You can hear it by walking through the rainforest and are continually washed over by sounds from all directions. And that clip just captures a small moment in time of that great sonic exaltation of biological diversity.
And this giant tree is also threatened by large-scale oil drilling operations?
Yes, so this part of the Amazon rainforest is not only very diverse above ground, below ground it contains tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil. And that's representation of ancient sunlight, the very rich area there that has now been fossilized and contained below ground. And of course, Ecuador is a country that needs foreign currency like every currency. It wants to use its natural resources to help economic development. And unlike the very affluent countries of Western Europe and North America, Japan, Ecuador is in a process of development where a lot of people are still living in quite dire poverty. And so there's a very strong economic argument to be made for extracting this oil. And yet people in the rainforest and then people who are concerned about biological diversity, of course, are not keen on large-scale industrial development of this part of the world, partly because the rainforest itself suffers greatly, both its biological diversity and the culture of the people who've lived in the rainforest for thousands of years is unwoven and fragmented when oil drilling platforms and oil roads move into areas. So there's quite a controversy about what to do about this. How should we live in relation to the forest? How should or should not the needs of the industrial economy make themselves felt within this community?
When you gathered and recorded Sabo's song, how did you get up in the tree?
This is a tree that has been equipped with some ladders. There are metal ladders attached to the tree. Mm. And so it's like climbing to the top of a multi-story building, although you can see through past your feet off the rungs of the ladder down far below. So people with vertigo usually don't do so well climbing this tree. So I had some assistance in the form of metal ladders to get to the top. They were originally installed by some Warani indigenous people for whom climbing a tree is not as fearsome a prospect as it is for me. I'm not as used to figuring out which vines are the right ones to climb up and so forth. So these people have just enormously impressive climbing skills and knowledge of the forest in its many dimensions, and climbed up this and then made this ladder access for people visiting the rainforest. Particularly, this particular area was and Tiputini Biological Station, where visiting scientists, both from Ecuador, from Quito, and from abroad, come to study the biological diversity of the forest.
And a song from a tree is more than a physical sound and more than acoustics. You can actually have your own inner responses. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I think, perhaps the clearest way to get to this is through an analogy with human songs. A human song is, of course, partly an acoustic phenomenon, but the song has meaning and actually becomes a song through the integration of our bodily response, what our ears detect, our intellectual response, what the lyrics and the context of the song mean to us, and then our emotional response. Of course, all human music taps into human emotions and evokes those emotions in us. So we're very familiar with this when we listen to say, popular music or classical music or hymns in a church context, we have an intellectual, an emotional, and a physical response to songs. The same is true with experience in the community of life, the biological community of life. We have a physical response to the sounds of trees or the sounds of birds or the smell of fresh soil in the springtime. All these are sensory impressions that reach us physically. We then understand them through our intellect to understand their meaning and their relationship with other parts of the community of life. And then we have an emotional response, which comes from, usually, from our history with that particular set of sensory impressions. For example, if the smell of freshly turned soil evokes memories of our grandparents working in a garden, or the sound of wind blowing through a pine tree reminds us of our vacations, or of the schools outside of the trees outside our elementary schools. Each person has their own context in which they receive these sounds and construct meaning. So the song is absolutely not just an acoustic expression. It's the integration of these different parts of our being that produces this what I call a tree's song. And there are other creatures that also experience this. Most of the creatures in the forest depend on trees for their livelihood, so they also have their own internal responses that are quite different, of course, from humans. Their nervous systems are arranged in different ways, but yet they do have nervous systems. So they have their own context in which they, too, receive tree songs.
We're talking with David George Haskell about trees and how they may be the ultimate networkers, standing at the nexus of communities, both human and non-human. David is a professor of biology at Sewanee, the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. His new book is titled The Song of the Trees. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. We'd love to hear your thoughts and questions about trees. That's 800-642-1234. News is next. Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Larry Mueller on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along. We're talking about trees and how they may be the ultimate connectors between nature and species, including humans. Our guest is David George Haskell. He's a biology professor at Sewanee, the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. His book, The Forest Unseen, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and his new book we're talking about is The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite tree? What is it about that tree that resonates with you? Does it lift your mood or bring you peace? Does it fill you with memories? Join in about your tree at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also post about your tree on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. David, let's go back to another tree that you met, and this tree, it has a plight. It's a palm tree on an island that's slowly eroding. It later fell. Let's first hear the song of this palm tree. David?
This is the sound of the roots of the palm tree. I lowered a hydrophone into the water on the edge of the palm tree. And this is a tree that's on St. Catherine's Island in Georgia. And when I started studying this tree, it was a dozen meters behind the dunes. And just 3 years later, the ocean was washing up against the tree's roots. And so this is the sound of sand grains being pulled away from the roots of the tree starting to topple. Now, my feet felt these waves as quite gentle, little washes coming over my skin. It felt it was rather pleasant and relaxing. But for the roots themselves, whose world is all about microscopic connections between the root cells and the sand that surrounds them, These waves were, in fact, a calamity. They were removing the land on which this tree stood. And so a few years after I started observing this tree, the tree was entirely engulfed by a high spring tide, and it fell. Its fronds that were once so crisp and tough and standing up in the salty air were entrained in the tide, and the tree is now entirely buried in sand and washed away.
Hmm.
This particular beach is eroding back at 6 meters per year. It's a very shallow beach, so a slight rise in sea level means that the beach is being wiped out at a very rapid rate. And so that through the life of this one palm tree, we hear a story that's a lot more global in scope. Of course, with climate change, we now know that the ocean is rising by 3 millimeters per year, three times the rate that it was rising in the 19th century, and that by the time our children are grown, the sea will have risen half a meter or maybe even 2 or 3 meters, displacing many people in coastal areas and causing great erosional problems. So the palm tree is an example of what's happening across coasts around the world.
Why did you decide to record this tree's song from its roots?
The roots are the place where we see, of course, our attention is first drawn to the above-ground parts of trees. But so much of the life of trees is below ground. There's as much root, often more root, below ground than there are twigs and leaves in the air. And through these roots, the tree gains its life. Of course, it's harvesting water and minerals from the soil. The palm tree has to deal with a lot of salt input and defend itself against all that salty water coming through. But attention to roots in the palm tree and then in other trees in the book. For example, the olive trees around Jerusalem have extraordinarily flexible and creative roots, if you like, as they seek out water in a dry environment. The roots are the place where a lot of the below-ground action is happening, and a lot of the symbiosis. So a root is not just a plant structure. A root is made from connections between plant cells and fungal cells and a halo of living bacteria all around the growing root tip that give the root its function and its life. So the root is a place of very active chemical conversation between different actors, plant cells and fungal cells, bacterial cells, even animals. So roots we used to think of as just plant structures. Now we understand that a root is, in fact, a community.
It's telling a greater story.
Yes, its story is tied into the physiology of that place, and it lives only in relationship with others. So relationship is right at the center of its being rather than being just one of the many factors that are involved in its life.
Let's take a call now, Connie in Portage. Hi, Connie.
Hello. I have something about trees that I have always, always loved. I'm 78, and in high school, I remember living on the farm and looking out at the trees, and I learned the poem. You should read the poem Trees today. I memorized that in high school. It's just wonderful. But anyway, where I live, I planted probably 12 trees in the last 10 years, and I just sit out underneath the big, big maple trees we have. They're probably 100 years old, and at my age, I just sit there. I get so much peace from the trees, and just thought I would share that. Everybody should hear that poem, too.
Do you talk to the trees?
No, I don't talk to the trees yet, or my husband would lock me up, probably. but I just have a feeling about them that they are, there's much more to them than we know.
Well, Connie, thank you so much for your comment. Yeah, David?
Yes, you know, what I'm hearing in this, I'm hearing many things in Connie's story. One is the sense of connection that she feels, and that the trees, although they seem to be so static, are in fact very complex beings. And her experience, her intuition is exactly right, that in fact biological science is only now just catching up with what we have understood in our culture for millennia now, that trees are living, dynamic beings. And there's a reason why trees are at the center of so many religious traditions. The Buddha was enlightened under a tree in the Garden of Eden. Christ means the anointed one, anointed with olive oil, the product of trees that gain their life and give life in the Middle East through providing oil in a very dry environment. So lots of complex cultural tales. The other thing I heard in Connie's comment was this notion of the future. Let's plant trees that we will get to enjoy in our lives, but also that will transcend the short arc of our own lives and live for perhaps centuries to shade and provide pleasure for future generations. And so in a tree, we also have our imagination drawn out into the future, into a time scale that is beyond the time scale of our human lives. And I think particularly at this time when we have so much uncertainty about the environment and political situation, economic situation, we like to touch down and check in with organisms that see perhaps the bigger picture and that are connected into the bigger picture. That's part of what many people enjoy in their experiences with trees.
And speaking,
to get beyond the self into their lives.
And speaking of their longevity, in the case of this balsam fir in Canada, that actually traces back almost 2 billion years. Can you explain that lineage?
Yes, and so this is actually the lineage of all of us. The balsam fir that I studied in Canada has its own fascinating modern ecology connected to our use of paper and timber. This part of the world is very important for paper and timber. And the tree is rooted in soil that is formed from flint rock that is 2 billion years old and that contains the fossilized remains of some of the oldest known creatures in the entire universe. So we should erect a shrine around this place. Here is the first sign of life in the universe. Those little cells that are now fossilized and caught up within this very dark, cherty rock, those little cells already existed in complex communities. They weren't single individuals. They lived in mats, very layered communities of different bacterial cells all working with one another, some eating the others, some acting in more cooperative ways to build life way back 2 billion years ago. So the theme that life is networked, that life is all about interconnection, is in fact one of life's most ancient themes, and we can see that in the fossil remains of the first life forms on planet, and then in fossils that are a little more recent, say from 30 million years ago, and then more recent remains like charcoal remains of human campfires from tens of thousands of years ago.
We're talking right now with David George Haskell. He's a biology professor at Suwannee, the University of the South in Suwannee, Tennessee. He's also the author of the new book, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. And we're learning more about this book this hour. We had a wonderful Facebook comment from someone who planted some trees on her property, and she said every time she passed this particular tree, a large oak tree at the edge of her property, Pamela said these words came out of her mouth with no thought. She would say, "Hello, grandfather." She doesn't know why that happened. It just did. And thereafter, she always said hello to Grandfather Oak because it just seemed right. How would you respond to Pamela on Facebook?
That's a wonderful story. It's a story of connection between people and trees that we encounter in our everyday lives. And here, what I hear is a response that is one of reverence and respect for this elder. And in fact, the trees, especially the larger trees, are indeed our elders. They contain within them, within their wood, literally, they contain the memory of the atmosphere and the weather, the climate over the last several hundred years. You can read that in the tree rings. And so this form of respect, I think, crosses many cultures. One of the trees in my book is 400 years old, and yet stands only knee-high. It's a bonsai tree that was cared for by the same family in Japan for 5 or 6 generations. So every day, for 5 or 6 human generations, people would be watering and caring for this tree. Mm. Then in the 1940s, the atomic bomb dropped. The U.S., of course, bombed Hiroshima, and this tree was located behind a wall, so it survived the bomb blast. And then on the occasion of the U.S. bicentennial in the 1970s, the tree was given by the Japanese people to the United States as a gift of friendship and of peace. And so this tree has within it stories going back 400 years, including these stories of connections among people. In the Amazon, as we discussed earlier in our conversation, these large sabo trees are also places where people come and pay their respects, people in the local community. So wherever people live closely bound up with trees, there's a sense in which these trees are our companions. They are also our elders, and we need to listen to them and respect them. And they're also our children in some way, the children of the community of our place. We need to be planting trees and making sure that the trees that sow themselves have a viable life. So there's this multi-generational dimension to paying attention to trees that I think is parallels the human experience very closely.
Let's take another call now. Annette in Soldiers Grove. Hi, Annette.
Hello. First of all, I want to thank you, David George Haskell, for your beautiful book, The Forest Unseen, of which I bought maybe 15 copies and gave them away.
Oh, wonderful.
Superb book, and I recommend it highly, and plan, therefore, to get your new book.
Thank you.
But here's my question. I came in late to the conversation. I don't know if you've addressed this yet, but I'm just wondering if you feel that trees have agency.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness or agency, yes.
Yeah, so those are questions. That's a difficult question, particularly the consciousness dimension of that, because, of course, it's hard to know that even another human being, it's hard to prove that another human being has consciousness. We can't get inside somebody else's subjective experience, except perhaps through literature and music and conversation, we get glimpses of the consciousness of other people. Now let's take that out into the forest. What do we do when we converse with the forest? Well, they don't speak a human language, but we can certainly, through the methods of science and through the methods of contemplation and conversation, we can understand the lives of trees, the lives of the creature, the other animals and the fungi that live with the trees. And what we learn through the scientific method is that trees have memories. They're able to make decisions, that they are networked beings, just in a similar way to the way the human brain is wired. The tree is wired into the soil. For example, one teaspoon of soil has billions of bacterial cells within it, and then several plant root hairs reaching into it, and fungal strands. There are as many cells and potentially as many interconnections within forest soil as there are within the human brain. Mm. That does not mean that the forest is thinking in the same way that a human does. Of course not. The human brain is comprised of animal nerve cells. The forest soil is comprised of cells that are communicating using different chemical means. So it's not a direct analogy, but there are some similarities in the process. So the forest, in a way, does have a mind. A tree has a mind of a very different nature than human mind, but it has a way of remembering and making decisions and learning about its place and adapting itself to its place. And perhaps the inner texture of that is different than ours. Some parts are faster, some are slower. The subjective experience, if it exists in a tree or in a forest, will be of a very different texture and rhythm and mode than ours. But I do think that as far as we can tell, using both scientific and contemplative and cultural ways of understanding the forest, there does seem to be a good case to be made for a mind and intelligence, some agency. Whether that results in consciousness is for the moment,
remains to be seen.
We can make that leap in our imaginations, but not in our scientific instruments.
Well, Annette, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Dave in Winter. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good afternoon. I used to work at the UW-Madison Arboretum. And there was a naturalist there who showed us and told us about holding your ear tightly up against the side of a tree, an example, a great white pine or a tall birch tree, and covering your other ear with your hand and listening to the wind going through the tree. Let me tell you, it is so simple to do, and it is really, really awesome to sit down and or to listen to that, and then, of course, sit down and listen to the trees talk to you as the wind's going through the upper branches.
David?
That is it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. That's such a wonderful, that's such a wonderful observation. And of course, when one does that, you quickly realize that a pine tree has a very different sound than a birch tree, and a pine tree in the winter sounds.
Oh, did we just get cut off? Oh, hello. Oh, I think we just got cut off here with David Haskell, and we're talking with David George Haskell. He's a biology professor at Sewanee, the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee, and his new book is The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. We're getting a lot of great inspiration right now from many people who have stories about trees, their relationship with trees. Greg on Facebook says he's been telling friends and family that when in nature, if you calm yourself, look inward and search your mind and body, and you can reach a state of being where you can participate in the conversation of the nature around you. The best he can do to describe the state of being is that your mind and body is on the same frequency of the natural world around you. Often trees are a big contributor to this conversation. Well, Greg on Facebook, thank you so much for those thoughts. And so many fabulous thoughts coming in. We also had a comment of someone who said they've been telling friends and family that when you are in nature, to calm yourself and to listen to this conversation with trees, because they tell things that we might not hear in other parts of our busy world that we live in, and so much of the time looking down at phones and looking at technology and not just thinking and contemplating about the sound of nature around us. So that is the essence of the book here by David George Haskell. He has conversations with a dozen trees around the world and even a tree in his own backyard. And David, are you with us now? Nope, still not with us. And, you know, it's really amazing, too, about some of these trees that he tells about in his book, listening to a twig on multiple days as it makes a unique sound, and listening to a twig versus a single day. So many, many interesting things. And in David's own backyard, he has, in his home in Tennessee, he also hears a lot of sounds from trees. David, are you with us now?
I am. I'm sorry, the line dropped.
The line dropped, and we are almost out of time, but very quickly, bring us to your backyard. We have about 30 seconds, and describe what you hear there.
In the backyard, I've put a little sensor on a maple tree, and you can hear the pulse of water flowing through the twigs. So every tree has a daily heartbeat, and I've connected little sensors to detect this. In the most ordinary suburban back tree, the world is full of wonders, and I've tried to turn an ear to them and share those stories.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, and listen out for the trees.
David George Haskell is a biology professor at Sewanee, the University of the South. His new book is The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. Thanks to Jill Nadeau for on-air production and to Dave Potraz for technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Coming up at 2 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn talks with scientists who share their motivations for taking part in the March for Science that's set for this weekend. That's coming up at 2 o'clock on The Kathleen Dunn Show. And tomorrow at this time, we're talking insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Hope you'll join in Wednesday for Wisconsin's Bug Guru at 11 here on the Ideas Network.